Sunday morning, March 13th, we just moved the clocks forward last night.
That's why we sounded a little tired?
That's why.
That's why, exactly.
And today we're going to talk about a subject that is sort of all-encompassing to what we've been discussing before, in the sense that it's about how we communicate with each other. The topic of this one is
the state of social discourse.
Discourse.
Which is a rarely used word in today's language because we don't have much discourse. We just have sort of yelling and screaming at each other.
I think since you have a great philosophy. Maybe you can start with this.
Sure. What philosophy do I have?
Well, about how when the news shifted over from having three or four main stations to hundreds, it got much more polarizing.
Well, I mean, I think we should look at sort of, or talk about the state of media is probably the best word, over time, right? I mean, if you go, I mean, over, 100 year span, 500 year span, right? Because if you go back to before the founding of this country, well before the founding of this country, very small elite group of people were literate, very small semi-elite group to elite group could write, and if you look at Europe in the Middle Ages, it was monks who could write and religious institutions that maintained scripts by hand, and the ruling class of nobility relied on them to conduct business, and people were generally illiterate. And they got their news and their information essentially from the church or the nobility. And they had local town pubs or the public square and gossip. And information was highly siloed in these very, very small micro areas. And then slowly, pieces of information would be grouped to unify people. And then the first sort of communication technological revolution was the Gutenberg press. And that spread like information like wildfire. I mean, we sort of laugh at it today where we say, we're used to sending an email across the planet in, 15 seconds and we go click, is it there yet? Is it there yet? But
it wasn't the first thing they printed on that press.
It was a Bible.
Bible.
Yep. Right. And that was a revolutionary act. Because the church controlled the Bible, the church controlled interpretation of the Bible, and to be able to have information be distributed and interpreted by the vulgar people was against God, according to the church, right? And they had religious wars over the ability to do that. So the difficulty of social discourse is not unique to us. It's this ever-evolving thing. And if you look at our founding fathers, right, what was one of the occupations of Benjamin Franklin? He was a printer, right? The ability to print and distribute information has always been a challenge and always been something that vexes governments and societies. So when the British lost the American Revolution, yes, on the battlefield, but also in the pub, right? Where did Americans generate their ideas? What was the public discourse that allowed people to sort of come to the conclusion that, screw king and country? It was nightly conversations over and over and over again in the local pubs in hundreds and thousands of small towns and cities. And slowly they swayed public opinion, and they had pamphlets printed and ideas printed. I mean, the mere fact that you could go to any printer and hand them a piece of paper with your writing on it and have them pay them and have them print 500 copies and distribute it in, say, 1780. Was a technological and information revolution compared to, say, 1480,
mm-hmm.
right? Where the church wouldn't print whatever you wanted. Only certain people could write. I mean, this was a vastly different world. And you can see the acceleration of change, you know, when you have the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution and revolution, because information and ideas started to spread, right? So ideas are great. Some ideas are better than others. And you can see in the Constitution the very protection of the free flow of ideas being important in the First Amendment, right? They say, you know, the right to free speech shall not be abridged. They say, you know, we will not establish a religion. These are all related ideas because the American Revolution benefited from the free exchange of ideas, and they want to continue that. I mean, here's a great example. Washington's army, when they're fighting in Massachusetts, were really beaten down. And, you know, Thomas Paine printed he handed a book that printed by Thomas Paine that galvanized the entire troops and had them continue to fight. You know, ideas matter. And the ability to exchange ideas is a good thing, right? People, I mean, again, it goes back to, do you trust people to interpret the ideas? Now, clearly, back in the day and forever, they would be spreading what we would say would be, fake news. Mm-hmm. And I think Adams and his presidential election was called a latent hermaphrodite and an unmanly man, right? You know, so it's not like the problems of fake news or incorrect opinions or, you know, haven't existed all throughout time. The question is, what did you do about it? The question is, how do you handle it? So,
also, when people would print stuff, it was almost like going on a bulletin board. It was largely anonymous. If you wanted it to be,
it could be.
You could spread rumors and propaganda and fake news.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not like, you know, we had...
With television, I think it maybe became a little, on the surface, more civil, because now you had a face,
well,
a graphic associated with that comment.
Well, let's go forward a little. Let's take this journey a little more iteratively, more linearly, I mean. So you have the printing press, and then the next great revolution in technology was the telegraph, right? Because as good as the printing press is, okay, you print something... You print 5,000 copies, you spread it around town, maybe you mail some from Philadelphia to Boston, and that takes, you know, 8 days to get there. It's not like we had real-time news,
mm-hmm.
right? Information was still largely localized, but it could start to spread. It could start to move. And newspapers became incredibly powerful because they became sort of the local, widely read information disseminators.
Mm-hmm.
And however, when we had the Constitution being developed, we had an incredible debate about the Constitution called what we call now the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist Papers, but they were opinion pieces written largely in newspapers, and they were written under pseudonyms, i.e. anonymously, but most people understood who they were. But to your point, it was, imagine having a giant debate on Facebook that everybody read. Everybody. Mm-hmm. About the most important political topics of the day. Now, we look at that and say, wow, that's really weird, because it's such a limited subject matter. But they look at it and say, wow, we could get everybody reading basically the same stuff, which was unusual. And then it comes along the telegraph, and now you can transmit basically Twitter-like messages across 1,000 miles in, you know, 20 minutes. That's the next revolution. And that changed warfare. And that opened the country up. Because if I could communicate the desires of Washington, D.C., to Chicago, to Denver in an hour, it changes how governments run. It changes how societies work. And then from the telegraph, we come to the telephone. So instead of having discrete messages, we can now have conversations. And that's why AT&T is called American Telegraph and Telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's the next layer.
Telephone and telegraph, or telegraph and telephone?
Nah, whichever. I go telegraph and telephone.
That's chronological.
Because it's chronological, but maybe I'm wrong.
But like, it's the other way around.
Yeah. Okay, fine. And then...
maybe it was telegraph. They added telephone, but they put it up front.
Fine, yeah. You know, you had to get that stock price up. And then the next revolution is radio. Right? In World War I, they literally laid down wires to communicate from one trench to another. Right? They didn't have wireless communication. To them, to somebody 100 years ago, wireless communication and the wireless device was the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And because you didn't need wires coming to your house. You could live in a non-urban area, right? You could live in the middle of Illinois, away from Chicago, 300 miles from Chicago, and nobody had to like put poles down and string a wire to your house to get news and information. You just bought this little weird box and turned it on, and lo and behold, information came to you. Mm-hmm. And
in real time, not time shift.
Not real time, not delayed, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, examples of the great beneficiaries of that technology, surprisingly, I would argue, are FDR, who had the Fireside Chat Weekly, where he could directly reach out to people's homes through radio.
Mm-hmm.
Where no other politician before that really had the ability to do that. And he could create a personal relationship with people. And shockingly, Notre Dame football. Because Notre Dame football allowed their broadcast to be free for a long time. And therefore they could create, again, this personal relationship with a large group of people around the country. It helped that there were a large number of Irish immigrants, and Notre Dame is an Irish Catholic institution. But they could create that connection. I mean, why is Notre Dame football a ratings powerhouse? Because they spent a generation and two doing that.
Yeah.
Right? So we've gone from handwriting information to the printing press, right? To the telegraph, to the telephone, to radio. And then we add another wireless device. The television. You know, I grew up, I'm old enough to remember, where we had little antennas, right? And you had to tune your TV into the right station, or it might be blurry, right? But you're widening the ability to distribute information, but you haven't reached sort of a tipping point. You still have sort of keepers of the gatekeepers on the information, right? The New York Times, ABC, CBS. New York Times is one of the largest regional papers because New York is such a big city, right?
Reminds me of this quote, press is free to those who own one.
Right.
In other words, if you had the machine, you can really exert your First Amendment rights more than anybody.
That's an interesting conversation, right?
Well, we do see, I don't want
to... No, please take it.
But we do see that the groups that are responsible for the different channels, whether that channel is social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or cable news, you know, Fox, CNN, et cetera, that they all have a particular point of view. They all stay in a particular lane.
That's new. That's somewhat new. That's right, new-ish.
But regardless, they're the ones who are putting across what end up seeming to become the primary ideas in any campaign.
Right, but that was the point. You were agreeing in that. I was trying to say, we have gatekeepers on the information. There are people who say, I control the mechanisms of the distribution of information, TV, radio.
So I'll filter.
And I will set what I believe is the important information to distribute.
Right, filter out the stuff that I don't believe in or subscribe to
subscribe
or
to.
Believe is true.
Right, it wasn't until you had radio and television, you know, very late historically, but somewhat long in the tooth for people today, that you had national broadcasting, national footprint,
mm-hmm.
right? The New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, right? The whatever, the Atlanta Constitution. These are the newspapers for a long time controlled what was sort of public discourse on news. And they were largely highly regionalized, right? People in Boston didn't read the New York Times. People in D.C. didn't read the Chicago Tribune in general. So while there were filters on the news or filterers on the news and what was important, it wasn't a national filter. It was this very highly distributed filter, right? What was important to a Chicago Tribune person may not be important to a a New York Times person, right? But we clearly had that kind of filtering. We clearly had that kind of filtering, right? Because we have an entire, class of people called yellow journalism and yellow journalists, where the idea was that they would color the journalism and they really promoted a particular narrative. Mm-hmm. So, and this happened in the 1890s, right? Early 1900s. It's not like people haven't recognized this problem. But it wasn't as impactful. It was impactful, but it wasn't as impactful because the newspapers didn't have a national reach. What the LA Times wrote didn't reach New York. It couldn't reach it for 10 days to, send it across the nation. But then you have radio, which started being built out in the 1910s, 20s, 30s, really got going in the 30s, right? And then you started to have a national footprint for news, a national footprint for discourse. Then you had TV and you had a multimedia national footprint. But still, I would argue, and this is good, comes up to the original point that you make, is that there were only three or four companies that had that national footprint, that had the ability to reach the entire nation. ABC, NBC, CBS. And they had largely, they had significant radio properties and television properties, right? So they've been in the national footprint discussion and control of news for a long, long time, right? And in that environment, where you've got two or three groups trying to compete for the national, the largest share of the nation, national eyeballs and eardrums, they kind of have to try to be middle of the road-ish, right? Assuming that most people are in the middle socially and politically, whatever the middle is at that time,
mm-hmm.
right? That the middle political and social of the country is 2/3 of more of the population, then it makes sense if you've got two or three competitors to not move too far one way or the other. Because if you become a right, if ABC becomes the right-wing ideologues, then CBS and NBC can sort of be in the middle, and instead of going for the 5 or 10% that are way on one side, they'll get the oogie middle and split it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had this interesting ebb and flow, but people in general got along a little more, because if you alienated people too much, it'd be a problem. Now, it's not like ABC and NBC and CBS didn't have their biases. It was Walter Cronkite who, to the clutches of pearls of people, said Vietnam may be lost, right? And that pushed people and, their ideas one way or the other.
The most trusted man in America.
The most, exactly, right? They looked to him because he filtered the news and told it like it is, right? There was an elevation of what he said because of the position that he had. And then the internet happened and everything blew up and everything became disaggregated because the New York Times now is not a regional paper, nor is the LA Times, nor is the Chicago Tribune, nor is the Washington Post. Anybody anywhere can get that information at any time instantly. That's the revolution of the internet, right? That you take whatever siloization of information and you destroy it. And as you pointed out, you don't need to invest hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars in equipment and printing and technology and staff in order to print and write things. You, as an individual or a small group of individuals, can create a blog or whatever, or now that it's come aboard, a Facebook page or a Google group or a WhatsApp group. Like, you can create any number of electronic media sources, YouTube, and produce your own television station, your own radio station, podcasting, your own whatever. And there are no keepers of the flame. There are no filterers of truth anymore. Right? Now, ABC, NBC, CBS, legacy media, they want to be that. And they try to be that to some degree. And they do control it to some degree, but not in the totality that they did. And that technological revolution is causing a fragmentation in our culture and our population, right? Because if you don't like what the ABC, NBC, CBS are saying, it doesn't sit with you. You don't sit there and go, well, let me see what else they have to say. You flick the station or turn the internet channel or go to a different website and consume the information you want. And on the one hand, it's extraordinarily good, right? Information is highly free-flowing, right? Here's a great example. Matt Drudge broke a story about a president's sperm on a woman's dress, and nobody believed it. But he put it on the news because he thought it was right. And lo and behold, he was right. ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN, they did not, come out with this news. This little dopey guy with a website that was an aggregator for news headlines, yeah. He did. Bang. And...
Well, also did he... I guess at that point also there was a certain element of risk. It was more worth it for him to send out this what might possibly be fake news, but he had a lead on it, as opposed to one of the big networks doing that and facing knows what kind of holy hell.
You think the big news networks face legal risk for publishing whatever they want?
Really? Against a Democratic president who was doing very well at the time?
What are they going to do? They're going to sue him? They've got armies of lawyers and billions of dollars. Listen, Matt Drudge is taking a far bigger risk.
Well,
he had no way to defend himself.
This is the same CBS you're talking about that killed the story, the story that became The Insider. They killed the story out of risk of lawsuits.
Well, you mean by the tobacco industry?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
It could be far less threatening than our federal government.
Or it could be far more threatening because they can act in a more private way. How does it look like if the federal government is suing a news outlet for reporting something on the president?
Well, how does
that look?
I don't think
really?
It's a lawsuit as much as potential for embarrassment, loss of confidence from the viewership,
yeah,
loss of ratings.
The Pentagon Papers ruined that, right? The Pentagon Papers, where the Supreme Court said you can pretty much publish anything you want if it's of public interest. Mm-hmm. So, no, I think Matt Drudge was taking risk because of the size of his company. not because of what he was publishing, but the whole point is that some small guy in a basement can publish anything and give it to anybody. That's a revolution. That's unheard of in human history until now, until the last 20 or 30 years. And we're still dealing with the social dislocation that these that new technologies cause. So what happens? Well, legacy media is like, that's fake news. That's just an internet site. That's not a real news organization, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tries to belittle the power and capability of these groups.
And you do see a lot of sensational headlines.
Sure.
Mostly because these places are trying to put themselves on the map.
Right. But like, we didn't see sensational headlines with the National Enquirer.
Oh, we did.
Wait.
But it came to be known, but we never really took it seriously. It wasn't a source of news.
It was a source of entertainment.
Exactly.
Oh, except when they, you know, showed that the governor of what, Virginia or North Carolina was having an affair, right? And they caught Gary Hart. Didn't they catch Gary Hart, you know, cheating on his wife? Right. Every once in a while, they, you know, like a clock, they were right twice a day.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, but for the most part, you can count on it. It was the rags you pick up by the cash register at the supermarket.
Right. Exactly. But you're kind of making my point, which is there's always been a hunger for it.
Yeah.
For that sensationalism. But now anybody can produce it. And the problem is every once in a while they're right.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to tell when they're not. Especially when the quote-unquote legacy media is wrong so often.
By the way, we've just gone up two hills, which is why we sound like we're on the path to heart attacks. But we're not. We're doing good. We're doing good.
Right. But now you have this high fragmentation of information, high interrelationship of information, right? Anybody can get any piece of information from anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's leading to a fragmentation of society, in my view.
But you also don't know whether a story that has a potential for being sensationalist is just not getting traction because it's not true, or if it's getting buried.
Or not getting traction because the powers that be that control the media don't want it to be so.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, right? Because now the stations and the news outlets and the websites, because there's so much competition, they have to micro-niche their audiences, right? Because more and more, you can't compete for the middle because there's so many people competing for the middle because it's so cheap to compete for the middle. So you go to where people aren't, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rush Limbaugh saw this and he said, I'm going to be a national conversation for conservatives because that market wasn't being addressed. And then MSNBC came along. I'm going to be a national conversation for left-wing liberals.
All very lucrative businesses.
All very lucrative businesses, right? But this is the problem with capitalism in general, is that if you're successful, you specialize. And as you specialize, you disassociate yourself from people who are not in your segment,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, here. Around 1900, something like 60% of all people worked or lived on farms. 60%, 6 out of 10 people in the country.
Wow.
Now it's 2 out of 100. Right? After World War II, 60 or 70% of the people either worked for or worked directly for or worked for an industry, a company that contracted with the Defense Department,
mm-hmm.
right? Highly unifying. But now we're so successful, we're highly, highly fragmented in jobs, in interests, and in media consumption, right? And that's why MSNBC vilifies Fox News. Fox News vilifies MSNBC and CNN. The New York Times vilifies everybody that's not the New York Times, right?
Mm-hmm.
because you're part of my group or you're the enemy.
Yes.
There is no reason to be in the middle ground, which is why MSNBC viewers vilify Fox viewers and call them stupid and uninformed. And Fox News viewers look at MSNBC viewers and say, you're stupid and uninformed, right? Because there's an element of truth in both assertions, and there's an element of falsehood that each group can pick up in the other, right? Does Fox News push stuff more than MSNBC that turns out to not be fully true? Absolutely. Does MSNBC push things that are false or should be known to be false? Absolutely. Right? Because truth no longer matters. A shared ideal of information no longer matters. Right? So if you get all your information from a single source or a single group of sources that are all bent ideologically one way, so they think the Trump P-tape is the most important thing ever, and that's all they produce, then you think that's the most important thing, right? But if you only consume news where the most important thing is Biden's, you know, perceived cognitive decline, then you think that's the most important thing. You can't understand why people don't see it.
Right. It's interesting that you invoke the word, well, not interesting, appropriate, you invoke the word truth, because even the word truth has been kind of co-opted.
Well, right. Well,
there was a famous quote, I believe it was Biden, you can have your facts, but we'll have our truth.
Right.
Which kind of...
It's like, what's the difference?
Well, it kind of says, wait a second, are you divorcing the term truth from the idea of facts?
Right. Well, which is why we have in academia, you say your truth. Like, what do you mean by truth? Either what I say is true or not.
It has to be called point of view, right, or opinion.
It could be point of view or opinion, right? And that's what makes history and political science and the humanities, it used to make them such fascinating subjects, because you had to sit down and think about what was important, right? What is the importance of history? What fact is important, right? Not, well, I have my truth and you have yours, right? So here's a potentially controversial but interesting example. Slavery, horrible. Absolutely horrible. Black people suffered, absolutely, no questions. Horrible, horrible, horrible. Cannot say how horrible it was. But it was also right-wing white Christian fundamentalists in the North who died en masse fighting to end slavery. Both of those facts are true. And there's no way to get around the fact that both of them are true. So for one group to say, well, it's really, you know, right-wing Christian fundamentalists that, you know, made the world better, and that's the most important thing and nothing else matters, that's not fully the truth. And to say, well, because there were some right-wing Christian fundamentalists in the South that supported slavery, right-wing Christian fundamentalists are bad, and the suffering of slaves is the only thing that's important, that's not fully true either.
Mm.
Right? The world and history and society is more complicated than those simple ideas. It's much more like a tapestry where each one of those ideas is a thread that makes up the tapestry.
Right. I mean,
the picture is more complicated.
But is it possible that we're learning these things first as school children? So it has to be kind of delivered in a very simple context. And then second, a lot of us don't, unless you're a history major or unless you have a very aggressive curriculum in you know, higher education, you're never really circling back on this stuff. See, you're essentially hearing what you learned in, you know, third grade, and that's how you're maybe chunking or analyzing that piece of history.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. You can't expect, you know, a college grad working a retail job as a barista to have a fully subtle understanding of every historical aspect of the Civil War. I agree. However, in my view, it also means that you shouldn't have national television people on The View and Whoopi Goldberg saying things like, it's just right-wing fundamentalists. Like the complexity of the issue should be recognized at the national level. Just, you don't have to understand every intricate detail, but just to recognize that it is a complex subject.
Right. And I think if you're going to sit in front of a camera and address the country in whatever format, maybe it's a good idea to know what the hell you're talking about.
Right.
Or at least admit that you don't.
Or if you don't know the details, at least say it's a complicated subject and there's a lot of intricacies here and let's talk about them. Right.
Right. People get in trouble for that too.
I understand.
Because it sounds like they're
copping out.
Yeah, copping out, or they're
Right. But go back in the day, in the '80s and the '90s, right? You had this guy named Phil Donahue.
Yes.
Right?
Love Phil.
Phil was great. Because Phil Donahue, he had a talk show, an hour-long interview talk show with an audience and a guest member. Think of him like a non-comedy-focused Bill Maher, right? And he would bring people on that he disagreed with.
Yeah.
And he would sit down and talk with them.
And he gave them respect.
And he would say, okay, I understand, but what about this?
Yeah.
And he would explore the idea. And in terms of discourse, because there's so much noise in the world now, and because you're competing for such a narrow niche of eyeballs and eardrums, you just blast the other side. You set up confrontation. You go after them because it's become tribal, because there's almost no unifying message or messenger anymore. Right? And that's why, how do you get from, ideologically, from the Enlightenment and Voltaire, who says, I may not agree with what you say, but I will fight to the death for you to be able to say it, to a nebbishy Jewish guy trying to go to Berkeley and a riot ensues because the Berkeleyite, you know, Ben Shapiro,
yeah.
Berkeleyite, Berkeleyite fascists or progressive fascists or whatever you want to call them are saying speech is violence. Like, that's the difference. That's the battle that we lost, and that's the thing that's affecting discourse in such a terrible way. Right? We can't talk to each other because it's fake news. How is you know, Ben Shapiro standing up and saying, facts don't care about your feelings. How is that violence? And by the same token, if that is violence, how is a left-wing person standing up and saying, all Republicans who voted for Donald Trump should be rounded up and shot, which has been said, how is that not violence as well? If speech is violence, how is one set of speech violence but not another set? And that's
because again, going back to the word truth, you gut the word truth and you call it my truth, and then all bets are off.
Right. Well, but it only matters if the coercive power of government is determining what is truth and therefore exercising that power upon the populace. And that's the scary part to me. The scary part to me is when the government says, oh, I know what hate speech is, and you're going to be punished for it. I know that, you know, here's a potentially controversial, but a great example. And sorry, I preemptively apologize for the language right now. Why should it be different when a black person takes a knife, jumps on another black person and says, nigger, I'm going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And a white person jumps on a black person and says, nigger, I'm going to kill you. One is a hate crime and one is not. Like, that's the problem, right? That language and ideas are not equally applied.
We know on the face of it, I get it.
Right. One seems to be racially motivated.
Right.
Right.
Using a highly charged racial
term. Right.
And the other one is kind of the way a community, you know, one part of that community seem to address each other.
Right. So
for, you know, as a good thing and as a bad thing, both for, you know.
Right. But why does the government, with its coercive power, get to make that determination? Why do they get to determine what is truth? They should never be in that position.
But aren't they doing that? Are the situations you're talking about where they have to determine the meaning behind the phrase in each situation, usually court, where they have to, I mean, is that where this conversation or that determination is being made?
Well, but again,
they have to decide the intent of the perpetrators in order to provide a reasonable prosecution and punishment.
But again, I have the right under the Constitution to speak freely.
Right.
Right?
Well, but take it closer to home. There's been attacks on, like the attack on the kosher market in France.
Uh-huh.
That was called anything but an anti-Semitic attack.
Uh-huh.
It was random. It was this.
Right.
And we kind of jump up and down and say, wait a second, the guy chose a kosher market. One out of, you know, 500 establishments in that area are probably kosher. This guy chose that one. So how can you say it's not an anti-Semitic attack?
Okay, but again, that's fine.
I mean, forget the fact that it was a place, but if he yelled a racial epithet.
But the government, again, he should be persecuted and prosecuted for the attack. 100%, 1,000%, no questions asked, right? If he had gone to a Somali market, or he had gone to a French market, or he had gone to, you know, a Russian market, those are all heinous, horrible attacks.
Right.
Right? That it was a Jewish market, sure, I'm happy for the news and people to say this was an anti-Semitic attack. It was. But the government should not have enhanced, you know, prosecutorial outcomes because Jews should be treated differently.
But they have a special classification for hate.
And they shouldn't. That's my point.
Oh, you're saying they shouldn't at all. Okay.
They shouldn't at all. Because...
So that means each punishment needs to be a lot harsher. Or... We're gonna de-emphasize how bad racial crimes are.
Well, but crime is what matters. Justice is what matters. It's not social justice. It's justice. It's not racial crime. It's crime, right? It's so bizarre to me. In 1954, I believe there's this, you know, pretty significant court case that said Brown versus Board of Education that said separate but equal is illegal. Because separate, by definition, is, you know, cannot be equal, right? Okay, awesome. Totally buy that. Let's desegregate every school. Totally agree. Well, except separate is not equal is okay in other cases. Like, how does that work? How do you have equality before the law when you separate people by race? You can't.
You're talking specifically about...
I'm talking about the use of language to separate people and treat them differently under the law, where under the First Amendment, I should be free to say whatever I want,
mm-hmm.
Right? There should not, I don't understand what hate speech is as a legal doctrine, right? Because hate speech as a legal doctrine is whatever the powers that be say it is, right? How come I can't, here, up in Canada, Jordan Peterson became famous because he said, I am not going to participate in compelled speech with regard to people who identify as trans preferred pronouns.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He said, I am happy to call them whatever they want to be called when they ask me. Mm-hmm. I am not willing to have the government step in and tell me under threat of penalty what I can say and not say. What I have to say. Right.
Right, and it's not like there aren't definitions of what threatening speech is.
Correct, exactly.
I'm going to show up to your house at 5 o'clock
and
with a steak knife
and beat you
and stab you 18 times. That's a direct threat.
Correct.
I want to, you know, I mean.
But calling a person who is born male a he, where they want to be called the she, that's not hate speech, right? But the government is saying it is. And the Canadian government was trying to criminalize that speech, right? And I support Jordan Peterson in saying that it is. But here's the real problem. The reason why the government stepped in and said this is a good law is because they believe that people who identify as trans should not be subject to offense, should not be offended.
Mm-hmm.
That's the ideal. Don't offend people. Except here's the problem. You ready? I'm offended that they would even think to be offended by that speech. How in God's green earth can they be offended by having somebody call them a name that they don't want to be called, right? And I'm offended that they're offended. Is the fact that I'm offended, does that hold any weight? How come they're able to say that I have to call them something? That offends me.
No, because there's a victim community.
Because, again, we are not equal. Because when we separate, we become unequal. And their offense is more important and more legitimate and more significant than other people's offense. The same rules do not apply. And that's the problem with discourse today, that we do not treat words the same. We do not treat ideas the same. We do not treat each other the same. It manifests itself that way, and it manifests itself in the scientific community, it manifests itself in news, right? You have the scientific community should be a cauldron of bubbling ideas that have to present their data and discuss and justify and be wrong. You have to be wrong in science. You have to prove other people wrong in order to be right. And that competition is good for everybody, mm-hmm. right? But COVID hits and it's, you know, whatever the CDC says, nobody else can say anything, despite email saying we know that this isn't right, despite emails saying we're hiding data, right? Big problem with discourse when we can't communicate with each other except through threat, when we can't talk to each other about our ideas except to say, you're a threat to me and you should be locked up. Mm-hmm. Your words threaten my physical being, so therefore I can hit you and riot and destroy property because you're a threat by your words. That's the level of discourse today, right? Because the megaphone is turned on and in everybody's hands, and we do a lot of yelling and shouting, but we don't do a lot of listening. We don't talk to each other. We talk at each other because the technology exists for us to do so, and the cultural climate is such that it's okay to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, and everyone wants their highest aspirations are to be a socially recognized influencer.
Well, some people, I mean, I don't really care what people think about how I dress or what, like.
No, I'm talking about, it, you know, extends just ideas as well. People just want they want an audience. They want.
Well, sure, but here's a question. We want an audience because we want to share ideas and discuss them. I don't want to tell people they're wrong. I don't want to say, oh my God, you're evil because you believe this. I think you might be misinformed. I think you have a different idea. But let's be Phil Donahue and let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. Right? Because unless we talk about it, we're just going to continue to fragment and disunify.
And there is no show like that on anymore.
Anymore. Right? You used to have...
Well, Oprah kind of took the mantle, but her shows became more specific.
So we used to have a show called Crossfire on CNN. Here's a great example. You want to see how things are doing? Used to have a show called Crossfire, which had Tucker Carlson and that other guy, who Alan somebody, right? And you had a liberal and a conservative on CNN talking to each other and at each other about ideas.
Right.
Fabulous show. Well, CNN said, nope, that's not for our audience. Our audience can't digest that. Got rid of that show. You know, turned leftward, and Tucker Carlson's now on Fox News, and CNN thinks he's the most evil person in the world. They hired him.
They paid him millions of dollars. Like, what happened?
Well, same thing happened to Lara Logan. She started at CBS on on 60 Minutes, and now she's on Fox.
Right.
I don't know if they vilify her for that, but
right,
she definitely had some events happen in her life and career.
Sure.
That influenced her thinking.
But,
and I don't think it's that Fox will just hire anybody and suddenly that person shifts over to a right wing.
No, Fox had
perspective.
Fox had Wallace.
Chris Wallace.
Chris Wallace, right?
Going uphill again. Yeah.
Yes. Chris Wallace, he was clearly a Democrat and they had him on for 20 years. Yeah. And now, this is not to justify Fox News as the end all be all. It's just to say, we got a problem in Kansas where we're so tribal that moving to another job opportunity is, you know, makes you an evil demon from hell. Mm. Right? Well, here's another example of discourse problems. There was a young Google engineer who was asked to comment on a public forum about women in technology, and he wrote a very detailed memo that said, you know, statistically, there just aren't as many women in engineering jobs and engineering classes, and they seem to be temperamentally not really interested in these things as much as they are in other things on average, and therefore it's going to be very difficult to get things to be quote-unquote equal. Vilified, fired, let go. Except, in the last 2 weeks, the CEO and the head of HR went on a news outlet and said, yeah, women seem to not apply to these jobs as much, and they don't seem to have as much interest, and it's just hard to hire them. Completely justifying everything that he said.
Yeah.
Right?
How many months or years later?
20 months, 25 months, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Right.
So they basically fired him because of their duty to this invisible agenda?
Correct.
And the PR blowback that would have ensued?
Because their truth was more important than the truth.
Yeah. Let's bring this down to sort of everyday life. I mean, like for me, for example, I have a very big difference of opinion on certain issues from my parents. Different, you know, than my parents.
Right.
And, you know, I find my mom and I will text each other these urgent messages.
Did you see this in the news? Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Not even that. But I'll just say, you know, gas prices again, blah, blah, blah. And she'll yell back, Putin. And I said, okay, well, what's the excuse up until 2 weeks ago?
Right.
And there'll be nothing. And then she'll say, well, what about Trump? And I'll say, well, what does that have to do with another? And she goes, well, you did it back here. And she'll quote something I said earlier.
Right.
And, you know, that's kind of our own sort of personal discourse. We don't let it get in the way of our family, our loving mother-son relationship.
Great.
And she keeps waiting for me to come around. I keep waiting for her to come around. But I also, you know, taking some of your advice, actually, when just started speaking about issues and not personalities, we find that we fundamentally agree on the same things.
Right.
At their core level.
Sure.
But there are certain, I don't know, idiosyncrasies, eccentricities,
biases is probably largely what it is.
That kind of, we only see things through a perspective.
Which is normal and natural.
Right.
Right. Your life experiences color your view of information and ideas 100%.
Right. And then it comes down to, well, I think every one of these conversations where we actually agree on something ultimately comes down to, well, let's see what happens next, or the country's still evolving, or the issue's still developing, or that's still being worked on.
So you agree to disagree until you get more information.
Right, which is in a way of kicking the can down the road.
Okay.
Yeah. And keeping the peace. But, you know, but what I'm also saying is that part of our texting arguments, I won't call them a war, is that, you know, I'll send a piece of video from this source. She'll send a piece of video from that source. I'll discredit her source. She'll discredit my source.
Uh-huh.
And I'll say, well, look at the facts. And she goes, the facts haven't been proven. And then 2 weeks later, in some cases, the facts will have proven themselves. And I'll circle back on it. And she'll be on to the next issue.
Right.
And that is a function of the whole thing we're calling discourse.
Right. The the plethora of information and being able to find a source that justifies your position.
Right? But not just that.
So
the timeline from when a rumor or a conspiracy theory is proven true is often greater than the news cycle, and therefore not as relevant or important 2 weeks later when that shell shocking news has been released.
Yeah.
Now it's more blunted because
the truth, right? A lie takes but an instant to travel the world.
But it's not just that the truth hasn't gotten its pants on yet.
Right.
He's the half of that thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
And the fact is, once the truth gets its pants on and gets out there,
so
the lie's already colored the situation. So the truth is not as powerful as it would have been had it been available in that moment.
And this is the problem with the plethora of communication, right? The lie gets out there, it gets spread and respread and disseminated, and then the truth comes out, but you've got this wall of published articles and videos that have the incorrect information, whatever it is. So my advice is a couple fold. One, you should only have conversations with people who are basically saying, I'm willing to listen. Right. If they don't want to listen, don't have the conversation. So if anybody you talk to is like, I don't want to hear you, like, all right, you don't want to hear, fine, don't talk. I'm not going to argue with you because you're not going to get anywhere. The second is to have an a priori conversation about, okay, on this subject, what is the important factors that we need to prove out? Right. You know, and what sources of data do we think are valid, right? Do I think that the Biden press secretary's spin on economic numbers is valid? No, she's spinning, right? I want to go and look at the U.S. Fed's actual raw numbers, and let's talk about the raw numbers because those come from the source. So let's agree that if we're going to talk about economics, we're going to go to the source and we're going to talk about it, right? And therefore, you're not having an argument about whose opinion is more important. You're saying, okay, let's talk about what facts do we, before we talk about what the facts are, what facts do we want to be important, right? So when you can talk, therefore you define the argument before you have it. So if you talk about gas inflation, right? You say, great, what's your starting point? Let's agree on a starting point to look at this. Let's agree on a metric to talk about. And let's talk about it. And then you don't have that, well, 6 years ago this happened, 12 years ago. And it lowers the temperature, right? Hopefully.
But I think also at the same time, it disqualifies 95% of the people from having any real conversation or discussion about it because they don't have a grasp of the facts.
Well,
but the facts they have might be skewed.
Well, but except
that's, or they're making stuff up.
But that's the point. You eliminate the information flaff. You say, look, we'll go look at AAA's average gas prices over the last 10 years. That's going to be the metric we're going to use, right? Mm-hmm. We're not going to use, you know, I drove down to my gas station and I saw this number. Right. That's not a valid data point for our discussion. Right. Agree on what data is valid and important. Okay. Because then you're not having, well, but this guy said that and this guy said that. And then you're not yelling at each other about the data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're actually looking at the data. You're actually looking at.
But there are different ways to interpret data, too.
Well, interpretation is the discussion, mm-hmm. not what the data is.
Okay.
And right.
Context.
Then there's context. Then you're having a different discussion.
Right.
You're like, okay, look, you know, everybody says, trust the science. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, let's talk about that. I'm happy to trust the science. Which scientific group holds the power? Mm-hmm. Right. And why? And therefore, before you even talk about transgenderism or same-sex relationships or COVID, or whatever, you're saying, well, is the Lancet the arbiter of truth? Is the CDC the arbiter of truth? Is, you know, any group of 1,000 doctors that say something the arbiter of truth? Right? There's always.
Well, but a lot of these conversations end up back at the Constitution. Sure.
And the
which they should.
Founding fathers, right, they should. But now, like, for example, I sent you a link I couldn't believe in where someone was saying basically we should throw out the Constitution. It's trash.
Right.
I mean,
and here's my pushback to him.
Awesome. You want to throw the Constitution away? I totally in agreement with you.
Go get either enough states to ask for a constitutional convention or enough people in Congress to ask for a constitutional convention, and let's have a constitutional convention. There's a mechanism to do the very thing that you want. I'm happy for you to try to exercise it. I agree with you. You have rights. Let's go do that. Right? Mm-hmm. And then what's his point?
Well, that's not fair.
No, his point is that'll never happen.
Right.
Because our country is systemically this way or that way, and it'll never happen, and we're stuck in the mud.
Then
we need a fresh idea. What he basically seems to be saying is, let's just throw it away, and I'll decide.
Right. I'll be a fascist, and I'll kill people who disagree with me, and I'll
not in the beginning, though, at the beginning.
No,
I'll
right.
get everyone on
but
board.
But that's why. But if you get everybody on board, then you can have the Constitutional Convention and do exactly what you want. So you can't have it both ways. Either your ideas have merit, and you can get what you want through the mechanisms that we want, or they can't, right?
Wow.
And you have to have revolution, right? So again, what do you want? What conversation do you want to have? What discourse do you want to have? I'm happy to have the discourse with this gentleman and say, I agree that you should have the right to say asinine things like the Constitution is a piece of trash. I support your right to say that. I support it so much that I support your right to call for a Constitution convention to ask that the Constitution be completely wiped out and whatever vision of what you want be put in. That's awesome. I think that's what makes this country great. You go do that.
Yeah, because there's a mechanism in the Constitution to
correct
revisit the Constitution.
Right, both, you know, writ large and on an amendment basis. 100%. Go do it. I support you. God love America. God bless America.
But he's going to say, well, now you've caught me in this cyclical thinking, which is now I have to use the Constitution to revamp the Constitution. And what I'm telling you, playing devil's advocate, of course, is that we should just trash the Constitution and start from a blank piece of paper.
And there are about 100 million gun owners that would say, go ahead and try. And that's why the Second Amendment exists, because we do not believe in government by fiat. We do not believe in totalitarian, you know, dictators coming in and telling us how to live our lives. There is a mechanism to change our lives. We support it. And if you don't like it, too effing bad.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you want to bring the Constitution down, go for it. But suffer the consequences when you reap the whirlwind. And that's on left or right. Right? We had a bunch of crazies called the KKK essentially create the temperance movement, right? And we amended the Constitution, and we had prohibition, and it was horrible for the country, and we repealed it. We have lots of mechanisms to change this our society, and if you don't like it, too bad. That's the world we live in,
mm-hmm.
Right? And you want to, if you really believe that the Constitution is so evil, you'll fight for it. And you'll suffer for it, right?
The difference in approaches, which I think causes a lot of the fundamental issues.
Yep. Here, let me summarize
discourse.
Let me summarize the differences.
Yeah.
If you're a conservative and you don't like guns, you don't buy one. But if you're a liberal and you don't like guns, you ban everybody from owning one. If you're a conservative and you don't like meat, you don't buy it. And if you're a liberal and you don't like meat, you ban everybody from buying meat. That's the difference.
Their argument, let me take their argument for a second. What I think they might say is, we're not talking about a preference. We're talking about something that is detrimental to some population, necessary for the world to thrive. And I'm taking a stance on it, not just my personal stance, but that the world should consume less meat because of the byproduct of all the cows and health issues and blah, blah, blah. And guns, yeah, I'm not going to buy a gun, but I don't want the neighbor's kid to find a gun. It should be by accident either. So I'm not clearly looking out for myself. On a societal level, these issues talk to me, which is why it's more than just about me. It's about affecting change.
But there's no end
to safety. There's no end to protection. You know, that's why Benjamin Franklin said, those that give up liberty for in the pursuit of safety deserve neither. Yeah. Right? Because if safety is your goal, don't be American. America was not founded on group safety. America was founded on individual liberty. It's as simple as that. Right? We didn't say, we hold this truth that society should be safe from harm. We said, we hold these truths that all men are created equal. And they should have the rights to pursue life, to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We were founded on individualism. We were founded on individual rights. We were founded, our Constitution is not built for people to give up essential liberty to protect everybody else.
Uh-huh.
Now, should we do things to protect people? Yes, of course.
Right.
But that's not the intent of the country. If you know, if you want to be safe, here's safety. Are you ready? Don't do drugs. You want to not be poor? Don't have babies out of wedlock. Can the government make sure that no babies happen out of wedlock? Because that would really reduce poverty. Is that okay for government to do in the pursuit of benefiting others? I mean, you know, homosexual men die at much earlier ages than heterosexual men. Is it right for people to say you can't engage in homosexual acts because I'm trying to save your life? No, it isn't. But the people who want to ban guns and meat and energy and things like that only want what they want government to do. The principle doesn't apply equally to people.
Mm-hmm.
It applies to whatever they want, because what they really want is power. And just as they don't trust people to have guns because they think people with guns will do bad things, many people don't trust government because the same people that they don't trust with guns are the same people I don't trust with government power. So again, if one person's offense matters more than the other, it's the same example. One person's distrust matters more than the other. And when we don't treat each other in that equivalent way, bad things happen. And that's why we're fragmented. And that concludes today's upbeat look at humanity.
Wow. Goodness.
Yeah, why don't we...
So what's... Just quickly, let's see if this
works.
What's the prescription then? Because we've gone... Everyone is an expert in their own niche. Everyone has their own lane or their own frequency that they're listening to.
Yeah.
Subscribing to. Where do we go from here? How do we unwind this?
Yeah, so...
Or
can we, right?
For mature past it.
So change starts with the individual. And people on left and right and center have to be open enough to listen to the other side, to engage the other side, and talk to the other side. Right? We can't be in a common space unless we find common ground. Right? And you can't find common ground unless the environment is such that both sides can talk. So allowing parents to talk to school boards who are doing things that they feel are wrong, allowing people to post videos that other people think are wrong, allowing people to post messages on Facebook that they think are wrong, that has to happen for people to talk to each other, to find this common ground, to be in a common space. Right? And it's interesting that it's just not happening. And it's the quote-unquote tolerant liberal left that is foisting much of this regulatory and legal and actual information intolerance. You know, I, as a libertarian, I want the National Enquirer and the New York Times and the Fox News and CNN. I want everybody to be able to have their say. I don't want to ban people. I want that marketplace of ideas. Yeah. But if
if
one side doesn't agree and one side says only these news stations and only these people and only, you know, you can only say these things or you'll be fired, then that's the rules.
It's just tough to be a smart consumer in a vast marketplace of ideas.
It is.
You don't have the time to shop.
Agreed, which is why the gatekeepers act as the proxy for you. But you have to trust them. And this is why America is an individual. At the end of the day, it's up to us. At the end of the day, it's up to us to be informed. It's up to us to carry out our will. It's up to us to vote. It's up to us to act. I am all for, you don't like McDonald's and what they said, don't go to McDonald's. Punish them for their ideas. That's fine. But the government should not be doing that, because the government is in the unique position as holding the coercive power of force in society. They should not say, oh, well, your idea is incorrect, so I'm not going to contract with you. Right? They should be ideologically free. Right? The FBI should be ideologically free. The national security, but they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem.
Well, is it partially because, well, it's obviously run by humans, but they just don't know where to. They don't have limits on their.
Look, because.
I suppose I don't know what I'm saying.
Yeah. They're human. Their biases come in, but either you, in one group has said those are okay because they're fighting the good fight, and another group is saying, hey, they shouldn't be. They shouldn't be that biased. And it's up to us as citizens to help tell the government what we want. And unless we engage, we're in trouble. And that's all I have to say today.
See you next week.